Is your child learning? Is she at the right school? Does she feel safe? Is she on track to college? Parents like you are asking questions, talking with each other, talking with teachers, talking with your kids. You're having a better conversation today to improve education for tomorrow. That's what we are all about at Education Post. Better conversation and better education. Because it's your child and your voice matters. Visit us at educationpost.org.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
This is my voice, my weapon of choice.
Well, good day, good people. It's Chris Stewart, and this is the Rock to School Show. I'm so happy to have you with me again. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about Oakland, which is becoming a new fascination for me. As I travel the country and I look around different in different cities, there's always a story that's somewhat the same, you know, in terms of schools and reform and who's fighting for what. And then there are the things that are just different and unique to the location. Oakland is definitely one of those places where there's something really unique going on, and it's been unique for a while. You have a strong black activist community, but it's also a city that is gentrifying right now. Many people are being priced out. And the schools have been in a long battle to improve. And you have what might be a little bit different there is, you know, a strong progressive and liberal class of people mixed with a strong kind of Afrocentric strain of community activists and partners. A very intense teachers union. And by intense, I think I'm being generous when I say that Oakland has a very intense teachers union. And then you have, you know, a district brass and district personnel who are really attempting to do something at a high level to change the schools and improve the situation for kids of Oakland. The dynamic between the rich and poor couldn't be more stark and direct. You have kids that go up a hill and go to schools. You have kids in the flatlands, and you have an East Oakland and a West Oakland that all have different things going on. My guest today is Charles Cole. And maybe you've heard of Charles. Charles has his own podcast. He's also a writer on Huffington Post. He leads something called Energy Converters. He's a young dude, and by young, I mean just younger than me, right? Who I think actually people need to hear a lot more from brothers like this because he's been in the trenches. He has his own personal story about how he has made it places where you know, people don't think that you're supposed to do well, you know, from poverty and from, you know, single parent household. And he made it, you know, and not only did he make it, he got lots of fancy book learning. You know, he did the whole kind of master's degree thing in social work and has seen schools in Chicago, Kansas City and Oakland and has done work on the reform side and the non-reform side, the community side. So, Charles, welcome to the show.
And just a quick correction: Kentucky, not Kansas. So lived in between Chicago, Kentucky, and Oakland.
So, question about that: is Kentucky and Kansas, are they really two different places? Sorry about that, man. I had to do
funny?
It.
I mean, I think out of those three places, when I was moving the most, I think Kentucky actually had me the furthest along on an education level. So,
wow,
for what that's worth. But yeah,
wow.
How are you, Chris? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great, man. And I thank you for being on today. You know, I really would love to center people quickly on the Oakland context. You know, if I was an alien and I was coming to planet Earth and I was trying to understand what really goes down with public schools in Oakland, give me the quick kind of tour of who's who and what goes down in Oakland with the public schools.
Right. Well, if you came to Oakland as an alien and that was the first place you came trying to understand education, your head would explode. That's first. Secondly, what Oakland is an ever-evolving place. I mean, we have our history around the Black Panthers and Revolution and all of these like things. And what you see now in Oakland is a hodgepodge of all these different beliefs kind of coming together and playing out. So if you go to Oakland, you will notice that there are a ton of schools per capita. I don't have the number right in front of me, but it's far more than what there should be. when you compare it to how many students we serve. And you have traditional public schools that are bleeding students. Buildings that are built to hold 3,000 students are holding 300 and 400 kids. And then you have the charter movement, which has seen a few different iterations. About 10 years ago, you saw the small schools movement, where they broke up these bigger schools and the smaller schools, and that had some very, you know, some parts of that were successful, some parts weren't. New administration comes in, the state takes over from receivership, and then you saw these schools kind of come back together. So what you have now is people leaving the traditional public schools in droves in Oakland and joining some type of charter network. And now what we have a new superintendent, Antoine Wilson, who is coming in, and I think that he's trying to hold a pretty high bar, but that requires for us to do some things a bit differently. And the rhetoric around charter schools, especially when you talk to black people and brown people, that term has just been demonized. So even though you've had these families, like so many families speak with their feet, right? They may not be out in the streets yelling and fighting. A lot of folks are choosing alternative routes to education. And Oakland is in the midst of trying to figure that out, because we are at a place where we have so many schools, whether they be traditional public or charter, that you're just going to have to start closing schools, right? Because it costs you money to run a 3,000 capacity school building, even if you only have 400 kids inside of that school.
Yeah, what's so weird about that, though, man, is that's the time when the community really does come out for activism, mm-hmm. and to be loud. You go try to close a school in any urban area, and I think there's nothing more predictable than the fact that that's what brings people out who get mad and loud and aggressive. And, you know, so for a question for you on that, I've met Antoine Wilson. He's a great dude, mm-hmm. man. And he's really,
yeah,
I think,
I like him a lot.
He's trying to do a lot of good stuff out there without all the, like, you know, all the community support, man. So what happens when you have a good, you know, like black man trying to run a system and improve things, and most of the activism is ginned up against him?
I mean, I think we only need to look at our president and see what that looks like, right? Listen, man, some people can't say this. I can. I think that there's just an inherent racism when you see, like, a man of color, like, in some type of power, and you have to and what I mean by that is there's just a different level of disrespect that you get to experience and see. I think that's one thing. I think, two, Oakland is a really insular place, right? So if you're a person that's coming in that's not necessarily from Oakland, people are automatically suspicious. And, you know, sometimes with good reason, right? Like, that's just kind of how, you know, people rock in the city. But I think, third, I think that when you try to change a standard at a place, and let me be clear, too, there were mistakes that were made when Mr. Wilson came in, and I think that they've recognized that and, like, apologized for that and trying to move on. I just feel like when you are a black male leader, people are just not as forgiving of your mistakes as they are of other people. But I think that when you come in, you're trying to change the system and you are trying to raise the bar, and there's a different level of expectation put on people, and when that has not been the case, I think that there's going to be a lot of pushback. In Oakland, you know, we're known for being passionate, and passionate can be translated into loud or disrespectful at times, or, you know, but, and while I do believe that a large part of that comes from a good place, I think that there are other groups that are just really well organized around getting their agenda out, right? So I want to use terms that people that's listening may understand. Like, let's look at the Tea Party. The Tea Party is a pretty small group, relatively speaking, right? But they're so organized, and they're so airtight, and they have no qualms about how they disrupt. And so you have anti-charter folks who actually, it's not that large of a group. It's actually it's a small, nimble group that operates at various levels. And they don't tend to have qualms about how they go about their business. So hacking into somebody's, you know, calendar and find out where they're going to be and, like, protesting and being really loud. Now, let's juxtapose that, right, to people that are happy with their kids being in charter schools and are happy with the education that their child is getting. And what they're doing is they're going on about their life. They're going on about their day because they're, for the most part, they're satisfied with the education that their kids are getting. So they don't have that extra added incentive at the moment to go out and to be as loud and to go out and give the alternate stories around what a KIPP bridge has meant for their child versus when that child might have been in West Oakland Middle School. You see what I'm saying? So what we've been trying to figure out is how do we hear more of those stories? Because I'm pro-child. I'm pro-education in general. I don't care what the method is. If the best method is going to be traditional public for that child, then there should be amazing options. But there should also be amazing options on the charter end because charters allow us to teach our kids in a way that traditional public just under the governance model, it just doesn't allow us to do. You know, and hopes to not be battling, right? I'm trying to paint a picture of what the landscape is and what the challenges are that are being faced.
Right. So, you know, when you look at that, you say you're pro-child. The charter schools are one way of which we serve children.
Right.
But you look at a place like Oakland. You know, I visited KIPP in West Oakland.
Best friend's son went there. Yeah.
Really? So, you know, I visited that school. I came in the morning. There were parents there. They were, like, just lovingly looking at their kids in this very kind of controlled environment. Had a very strong building leader in the morning. And, you know, walking away from that and digging in a little bit and seeing what their results were and seeing what the results were for the traditional school that's right there near it.
Mm-hmm.
It's night and day, right? There's just no getting around.
Yeah.
The KIPP school there is kicking all kinds of butt, right?
Right.
And at the same time, you know, there's an idea that maybe then you replicate that. You should expand that.
Mm-hmm.
The community response for some, and I don't know how many it'll be, but for some, the community response to that is not one that's supportive of those results. It seems like what's being ginned up in the community is to say, these schools that get really great results for us are somehow bad for us. So help me understand kind of like the community psychology to not just be pro-child and say, I don't care who does it, it's a good thing, to get lost in all these kind of liberal, progressive, white unionist politics and suck down that Kool-Aid so bad to where you don't even want to support things when kids are doing well.
Well, I think, one, when you yell at people enough, they start to kind of, you know, listen, the thing that's going on here in Oakland is, man, it's tough. It's tough, Chris. And, you know, I've done a lot of work on the ground and kind of watched that. But here, one of the fears is that those schools don't serve our kids. That's like a narrative, right? So the difference between West Oakland Middle School and KIPP, which is on the same campus, for the people that are not familiar with our schools, West Oakland Middle School tends to serve walk-up kids. So kids in the neighborhood, kids that, like, live within that, you know, within a 7-8 block radius of that area, you know, tend to be a bit poorer. If you look at the how much parents make from this child versus the children at the other school, you can see some significant differences, right? Whereas KIPP, what people are saying is, well, people are bringing their kids in from Berkeley. People are bringing their kids in from Oakland Hills. People are bringing their kids in from Alameda. And these parents have a different income level, have a different education level, and all these things kind of go in and help to get those results that a KIPP gets. Now, some of those things are just facts. I don't think that's what the magic sauce is. I think that there is a system there that people have bought into. And that's not to say that KIPP doesn't present its own set of challenges and problems, right? Like, I'm, you know, like, anytime I see a kid on the tape, right, it's an interesting thing, right? But these parents have a level of involvement with the school, and you're starting to see results from that. So what that turns into is that narrative turns into, well, this school, you know, and we have a gentrification narrative that is happening really, really loudly right now. right? So my family is the subject of, like, gentrification. Where I grew up in North Oakland is very different than what it is now. And my parents, because of those things, don't live in the city anymore. So what people see Kip as is being, like, another block in the gentrification of Oakland. If we don't protect and safeguard, you know, how we're doing things, there's not going to be any, like, black people left or, you know, and that becomes the narrative. And then that narrative goes unchecked.
But that's crazy to me in this one way. I mean, this is what's crazy to me about it, is those kids are all black. And the idea that they're coming from, you know, like, Tony families in some way, shape, or form, they're damn near all poor, right? Like, so it's like you got an all-black, damn near all-poor school that is beating the odds. And if you visit the schools and if you walk through the two, the very visible difference is kind of order and discipline and structure and how you lead. And maybe it's not for everybody. For instance, to be in a school that has such a strong kind of system of the flow of the day and how you move from class to class and all of that type of stuff. But then again, you can visit schools in the suburbs and everywhere else and walk away saying it's not for you. Right. Like, not every school is for everybody. Like, I figured that out with my own kids. Not every school is for everybody. But here's the thing. The kids that are coming into KIPP are coming in, like, many grade levels behind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're leaving at a very high rate on pace and on track. So this to me becomes a thing about, like, do we want results or do we want to have the happy school where nobody's learning and we're turning out inmates?
Chris, you gotta pay attention to the question that you asked. I'm giving you the narrative. You're dabbling in this thing called reality and fact. I'm giving you the narrative of where things those things act as the boogeyman. You see what I'm saying? Like, that becomes a narrative. Like, people that have never stepped into that school or seen that building or went into a classroom or saw those kids interacting and engaging at a high level, right? Like, they've never seen that, but this is the narrative that they have. This is the narrative that gets repeated. And so this narrative gets repeated amongst people that you trust, and so it turns into that. And when you add in just how visceral the repel is for people from these types of schools, right? So listen, I sat there and I go to all the school board meetings, even when they go to, like, 1 a.m. I've taken a break in the last few months, and I've heard people demand closure of a school that is at the top tier of not just in Oakland, but of the state, simply because you don't like charter schools.
Mm.
Like my nephews go to a charter school. It's called Berkeley Maynard. When I was a child and their father was a kid, it was in North Oakland. It used to be called Golden Gate. And the school was so bad. It was so raggedy, Chris. And this Aspire came in and built Berkeley Maynard. And it is night and day. Like, my little nephews are getting an amazing education, right? And somebody was trying to advocate for that school to close. And here's the difference. So I had a talk with his father about it, and his dad, like, this is the issue. My brother, my best friend, is not coming to the school board meeting because he served in the Army. He did 3 tours. He went to Iraq twice. He went to Afghanistan once. And he is comfortable where his kids are, so he goes on, he's living his life, and he's doing other things. Like, this is not his priority because he's not in that type of struggle. But because you don't hear his story, because you don't hear that black man who served this country, who grew up in the slums, whose dad was on crack and left, who did all these things, and see how successful he is and the decisions that he's made for his child, that entire narrative is missing from this conversation.
And that's huge. I mean, that's really huge because, I mean, you know, sometimes when people are satisfied is when they're the most, you know, I think silent.
Yeah,
you know, when they it's the people who aren't satisfied. And, you know, maybe we're hitting on something different, too, because if I want to whip up community antagonism against specific targets, and charter schools are the targets, I actually put organizers on the ground to do that. And I start making, building relationships with the most shrill and loud voices. And it seems like you all in Oakland have some old school and new school voices that are willing to be militant about anything, that would be easy to organize against almost anything that the superintendent there is doing. But getting to people like your brother and getting folks like that to understand that, you know, what they do appreciate about their charter schools or their schools in general could be in jeopardy. What do you think is the move for them?
I think that you have to show people, and I don't want to push fear on folks, but I do think you have to show people that if this gets enough steam, your school that's actually functioning at a high level could look very, very different or not be existent. And these are the conversations that I may have with my brother. Now, here's the thing, right? Like, you and I eat, live, breathe education, you know, and that's our focus. You know, and I look at someone like him, and he'll tell you this, like, he's a veteran. He's a soldier. Like, he's trying to do military reform. Like, he's thinking about, like, all his friends that are coming out and are having nightmares and are trying to, you know what I mean? Like the people that he knows that are contemplating suicide or having it. Like, there are so many issues, like, that people deal with. And when your school is actually functioning, when you actually don't have an issue in that area, right, like, you know, it allows him to go off and focus on other things. Because as much as I may try to talk to him about education, he's also trying to pull me into this conversation around veterans, right, because my father was a Marine and my uncle was a Marine that served in Vietnam, right? So he's looking at me the way I look at other people about education, right? It's like, no, you need to be in this fight. So, but there's a certain level of comfort, and there has to be a certain level of discomfort that kind of motivates people at times to kind of to do something different. And I think for some people, those meetings are intimidating. Like those school board meetings get, you know, it's hard to go up. Like, I don't have a problem with it because I do it and this is what I live for. But it's hard to go up with people booing you, people in your community booing you, people that you grew up with. So let me give you an example. I grew up in North Oakland. I didn't grow up in a single parent home, but both my parents were on drugs. And so I was homeless. And then my parents were both in and out because they were in and out of jail and things like that. And like, I grew up in these communities. And when I started doing this work and I didn't denounce or decry charters or even on some level, maybe even vouchers, whatever, right? I am a pretty progressive person. I was the vice chair of the California Young Democrats Black Caucus, and I started East Bay Young Democrats and co-founded San Francisco Young Democrats, or Black Democrats, right? Like, just to give you an instance of where my political leanings are. But education, I'm like, by any means necessary type of person. And my mother was forced to send me to a school that she was afraid of me to go to. And my mom didn't know what the teaching was. She didn't know what quality education looked like, but she just knew that the schools at OUSD wasn't it. And so she tried to get me into the high school, Berkeley High, which is in Berkeley. It's a great school if you know how to navigate. And she couldn't do it. And my mother was about to, like, try to get somebody's address to put me into that school. And she could have went to jail for that, or at least that's what she thought. You know, like, I just remember my mom just being so upset and just not knowing what to do. You know, because we didn't have these charter options at the moment. We didn't have, like, these voucher options or any of this choice stuff, right? So I channel those things when we do the work that we do. And I think that people should be able to choose to do what they want to do. If my mom was white and rich, she isn't, regardless of what the system in OUSD is or in Minnesota or wherever, she has options of the delivery system for education for her child, which is a traditional school, if that area has charter schools, or private is an option. Like, so.
Yeah, and the pushback on that, though, that always comes back. I mean, because this is the compelling part of the story. Those of us that believe in school choice and believe that people should have options, many of us have lived the need for those options. We're not pulling it out of a hat. We're like, looking at our real life circumstances. In my circumstances, I definitely needed better options for myself. And then when I became a dad, there was just no doubt about it. I was very crystal clear on the understanding that rich people were having options that I wasn't able to have. No. Right. So we're not pulling this out of a hat. This is coming from a real place for us. The pushback on what we are saying, the need for choice is sidestepped, and people jump right to kind of the neoliberal kind of conversation, the whole conversation about how it's just, you know, school choice isn't something that people actually need. It's just a big trick from the other side. I think in some ways what you and I have in common is that we have had a foot in two places, one on the real side of life, you know, just our own mm-hmm. experience and whatnot, and others a foot in the school, you know, kind of reform movement, whatever we want to call it nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we collect a lot of heat from our own people about that often. And I know right. you collected some heat. So we're going to run to a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your time with TFA, because I think that is a perfect example of how you can be a person like us and have an employer where people want to put you down just for your employer. But let's take a break real quick, and then we're going to come back and pick up on that.
Brotherhood Brew distributes fresh, organic, fair trade coffee to businesses, coffee shops, and companies that appreciate its mission to give to the community. By employing the most vulnerable in our population, Brotherhood Brew's mission is about giving hope and a second chance to young men who have been involved in the criminal justice system or who are at risk of such involvement. For more information or to order product, please visit our website at brotherhoodmn.org. OMG Media Solutions, promoting innovation and entrepreneurship education in schools. For more information, go to omgmediasolutions.com.
All right, we're back on the other side. Kind of an interesting choice in songs there, which is Kendrick Lamar, Hood Politics. I am talking to Charles Cole today a little bit about hood politics, not nationally, but in Oakland, where Charles lives. And Charles, that's no bearing on you. Definitely am not trying to point you out as being a hood politic dude, but that was a pretty smooth song. You know,
and that doesn't bother me at all.
All right. Good. You know, I wanted them like upright individuals that would be ashamed of such a thing. Here's what we left off before we went to the break. We were talking a little bit about how you can be a person who is advocating for school reform from the basis of real life, real lived experience, and have it come back to you from people that fight against reform. They paint you in a certain way, and the way that they paint you is basically saying that you are a tool of a right-wing kind of global planetary conspiracy to tear down public education and make sure that good white women don't have jobs as teachers anymore. So in thinking about that, you worked for TFA locally mm-hmm. in the Bay Area, which I think has some interesting kind of cross currents going to it. When people think of TFA, they think of this kind of large organization, and it's part of you know, this big reform movement, and you hear words like hedge funder and all these kind of you know, it's painted as being something that never seems to live up when I meet the actual people from TFA,
right?
And it really, in your case, really makes no damn sense because of what you did. First of all, who you are and where you come from, and then two, the market that you're in, the area is just so different. So tell me a little bit about kind of your work with TFA, how it's a different thing than what people usually think of when they think of TFA.
Yeah, no problem. I was a director at Teach for America. The West and North Oakland, I worked physically in all areas. And what we try to do is we want to be really intentional about building out some really high-quality education seats for young people. And that took a lot of strategy and a lot of work and a lot of groundwork. And one of the things that I wanted to do is I wanted to make sure that we had a teaching corps that was representative of the community. And what that means is racially and both I have some roots in the Bay Area.
So how'd you do? Let's talk raw numbers, real numbers. How did you do?
So in real numbers, I wish I had the paper in front of me, but we brought in one of the most diverse group of teachers that we've ever brought in. So almost, I would say maybe 60% of the teachers that I was overseeing were people of color or from the Bay Area. And that number is pretty shocking. That statistic is pretty shocking to people when they try to come for us around saying we only had these white young folks from Harvard. I had nobody from Harvard. My people came from living around the corner, and I placed folks in. We helped not place. We helped people get hired in schools that they attended, and we thought that was just really impactful. So the way in which we would do that and we went about it is at TSA, everybody plays a role in recruitment of teachers. So you get all these people, like you do phone interviews, you interview folks, like you talk to them about the landscape. And so I wanted to talk to all the people that were from Oakland, and I wanted to talk to those folks, and I got a big chunk of those people. And we talked about what it meant to be a teacher from Oakland or the Bay Area working in Oakland, and what was coming ahead of us. And I want them to be prepared for, like, whatever backlash they're going to get. But we're here for one mission, and that is to educate young people. And for me, it was especially black and brown poor kids. And I would name those things. And I think that when I named those things in front of folks that were skeptics of TSA or what we did, like, it shocked them. It threw them off. And then they would, you know, assume that I went to Harvard and grew up with a bunch of privilege, and then they'd learn my story. And then they learn my story, and it would just be, you know, a crazy situation. Hello?
Yeah, so they, you know, when you talk about that and you say it was a crazy situation, your thinking is that they're taking you to be some kind of dude who came from, you know, like Ivy League and a background that is rich and wealthy and all that stuff. And as it turns out, that's not where you come from.
Not at all.
And not just you, but the, you know, when you say you're having like 60% of the people being teachers of color or from, you know, indigenous to the local area, nobody is doing that. Right? Nobody's doing that. Teachers are not, that's not what teachers look like. Nationally, teachers are darn near like 90% or so, 80 something percent.
White women.
White. Yeah, white women at that is. I don't know what the breakdown is, but it's mostly white women, right? So you have areas like New Orleans and Oakland where, you know, in New Orleans, 54% of the teachers are black, not even of color, but black, right? Mm-hmm. And you're telling me about Oakland where you've got 60% of the teachers that you're placing. TFA looks different to me because of that, to be very honest with you, those type of stories than what the real story is. But you know, so you move on from that and you start having more interaction with the community. You go to a community-based organization. What does your transition look like? What have you learned over the last 2 years as you've transitioned out of that? What are you starting to see as kind of your role as a black man who's been on all sides of this thing?
Right. And just when you say all sides of it, like I think you talked about it earlier, like I started my career as a social worker working with families and people inside the schools. I was a director of a youth program that worked with kids and through college and then TSA, and now my work overall. And I see my role as just being a warrior for this movement. And I think that people need something familiar that they can identify with and they can see themselves in, and then they start to listen. So we're at, like, people that just may repel from like the term charter or reform or whatever, like I don't open with that. I've always opened with who I am and what I care about and who I am at my core. And then I talk about what it is that we're trying to do. And I don't run into the same issue that a lot of reformers run into. I don't get a lot of resistance. I think you've been with me one time where, like, people try, and when people actually try, and I talk to them for 3 or 4 minutes, what I've learned is that then they try to separate you from the movement. So what will happen is when you're effective and they know that you're, like, focused on great teaching and great practice and just liberation for, like, these little black and brown kids, then they say, oh, well, you're different. Oh, well, you know, they try to separate you.
I saw that at a dinner you and I were at, as a matter of fact. Like,
yeah, right.
We are having right. Caribbean food and a cool little, like, you know, joint table of black folks. Very kind of like, you know, grounded black folks. doing good things. Exactly. And one of them was very anti-TFA, but she was like, you know, when she's talking to you, she was kind of like, yeah, but, you know, you're an outlier, right?
Right, right. And this is interesting. I didn't even come off, I didn't even say I was TFA up front. I just let people talk, right? And I let people misquote things and just be wrong. Because this is the thing. You get to, like I did with you earlier, you were really interested in facts and evidence. We're talking about a narrative. A narrative can be completely fiction. You know, perception becomes reality for a lot of people. And so I let people talk, and then I'm like, actually, this is what we're doing. This is what the numbers are. Like, Chris, what I was doing in early July is I was in Atlanta, a part of a group that I was a founding member of. It's called the African American Core Member Summit in Atlanta, and I didn't start it, but I've been there since the inception. This is the third year. But we fly out 200 black teachers to Atlanta, to Morehouse, under TFA money, but we go in real big once we get there. We talk about being a black educator, educating black kids. Like, we don't skim around things. We don't say, you know, we don't try to make people feel comfortable in that, but we have real hard-hitting conversations and trainings about what that means for you and what that means for this community. And, you know, people wouldn't expect that, right? They wouldn't expect these type of crowds. And I don't know how many people have ever seen 300 black educators in one space. It's just not something that you see on a pretty regular basis. And TFA does, like, you know, they do that for Latinos and Asian folks. I'm not in those groups, so I don't go to those. So that's the thing. So my role is helping to change the narrative and put a face on it that people can identify with, to be earnest, and to, like, really just to put my heart into this work and to give you the truth, right? Because if something was to miraculously happen tomorrow in traditional public schools, it just like the best, and there was no need for charter schools anymore, and our governance systems changed, and we got to teach kids the way in which they learn the best, then, oh, I'm on that boat. Like, yeah. I'm not beholden to anything. I'm beholden to our babies learning and getting the things that they need to get, because the difference for our kids, Chris, it's not just like them going to college and getting a degree. For a lot of these kids, and I'm doing this conversation at my house, and on my mantle is like a picture of one of my best friends who's no longer with us. He's dead because there was a different lifestyle that he had. And I remember being in ninth grade in our world history class, and he got asked to read something out loud. And I've known this kid since we were like little kids having milk and cookies at my house playing sports. That was the first time I ever heard him read. Like, my friend was functionally illiterate, mm-hmm. you know, and school wasn't for him. And and we buried him. So I'm not worried about these people. I'm not worried about these folks that like are just hell bent on. You know, going along these party lines or using our kids as these pawns, or, you know, I'm not with these folks that's putting adults before kids. Like, kids come first. And if that means higher standards for people, if that means higher standards for teachers, for administrators and principals, then so be it. But somebody has to stand in the gap and protect our kids. And when I look at the face of these movements that are anti-charter, that are anti- like reform, you know, I see older white people. I see folks like Diane Ravitch who will never, ever, ever, ever have to send her child to McClendon High School.
And that to me is the crazy part about this is we let them get away with that, though. I mean, that's the real crazy part about that is, I mean, there's two groups of people that are pushing anti-reform. You know, old white unionists and the young people that love them that have a vested interest in a monopoly on education being delivered in one way, and that's through mm-hmm. unionized, district, state-run, state-owned schools. And they have a vested interest in that. And by law, their jobs are property, not jobs. They're not public servants. They are people that have a very good, no-bid, Halliburton-like deal with the government, where they have jobs that are property and you can't take them from it. And let's get our minds around this for a second. Because if you are a majority white occupational class and your job is considered property, when we fight them, we are fighting against white property rights, right? That needs to be something that we need to get our minds around, because our kids – should not be beholden to white property rights when it comes to the intellectual development of their brains, their minds, right? But they have got this system so kind of locked down. And the part that kills me the most is the black middle class and bourgeoisie that lives off the education system that doesn't challenge them at all. In fact, joins them. And not only joins them, but joins them with this, which is the most dangerous thing for us at all. They join them in their kind of false narrative about our children being the problem, and that poverty reduces the brain size, and that there's nothing that can be done in schools and in classrooms. We can't expect schools to cure all the ills. Test scores are highly correlated with poverty. You know what? Test scores are also highly correlated with white skin. So what are we going to do? Outlaw blackness, right?
So well, we kind of have. So we have, right? And here's the thing, right? Like, and I want to see wherever a kid is sitting down getting educated, like, I want to see that be the best it can be, whether that's in a traditional or that's in a charter school. But let's be clear. Like, let's really be clear. This the anti-narrative does not serve black and brown poor people.
Not at all.
You know what I mean?
No.
And we know, parents play a big role. But how about this scenario? How about when those parents are absent? How about when those parents are on drugs like my parents were, and they're out in the streets and I'm living from shelter to shelter and I'm going to school? Like, yeah, parents play a big role, but my parents are not here. So now what? Do I just need to just fall by the wayside? Do we just throw our hands up? Or do we have a school that is saying, you know what, we know how important the family structure is, and we know that a lot of our kids are lacking that structure, so we're going to go above and beyond and change the way we're educating people. Like, it's not the outlier anymore of, like, this isn't the 50s and 60s where, you know, there's, like, one or two parents down the block that and maybe a divorce happened, or maybe, you know, when you are serving in an impoverished area, when you are serving kids that are poor and parents have whatever social issues and there are so many single-parent households and all these things, when this is starting to become somewhat the norm, you have to have a system that can morph and change and grow, understanding what we're fighting against.
And that's what's so, I think, backwards about the system right now is the system is saying we don't want to change. The situation has changed. The students, the families, and the parents have changed. And we can't do anything about that, so you need to go fix them so that they will be appropriate for our institution, which is exactly backwards, right? Like, schools aren't supposed to be an institution that are static and unchanged, and if the student population changes, nothing happens. This is, to your point, this is who we have now. These are the kids that we have. The reason you have a job, your property, your white property. The reason you have that is because these kids exist, right? And black per pupil allocations are what funds the thing that you make a job, that you have a job in now. So to basically say, I'm a great teacher even if the kids aren't learning, or, you know, if our schools are, you know, the whole thing about thank a teacher if you can read, if you can't, blame poverty. That's where we're at right now in the debate. We're in this debate where they're not doing what you're saying, which is saying this is the norm. We're in the new normal now. The new normal is that we have lots of wealthy schools and suburban and middle class schools and islands of privilege, and then we have all these other schools serving kids that are only making them more marginalized. And I would like to say for the record, it's a very low bar that we're trying to get them to. When we talk about proficiency in reading and writing, we're not asking you to cure all the ills of the world. Really, we're trying to ask you to get kids to this very minimum bar of proficiency in math and reading so that they can read, right? When you say that your friend was a functional illiterate, that is something that is workable. We could do something about that. We may not get you to Harvard necessarily, but damn, we can get you to read, right? And especially after 12 years, right? If we have you for 12 years and professionals are getting paid for 12 years, you should be able to read. Right. So we are coming up to the end of our hour, Charles. Give us kind of a moment of zen. Give us like what's the thing that you see at the end of the show? You know, I like to ask people, the thing that gives you hope, or, you know, kind of the thing that you see that you think we're on the right track. What is it that you see that should give people hope?
I see a new group of people like yourself, like some of the other people that we may know, these educators that have fire in their belly, and that are willing to get our kids educated by any means necessary, that are not wedded to a conservative or to a liberal viewpoint, but are wedded to the idea that all kids deserve the best education possible. Those are things that give me hope, because I'm not going to stop. Like, I'm not going to stop running my mouth and running my pen and doing what it is that we do. And I've had the pleasure of being able to see people make that shift and to see people get educated. And that's a beautiful thing. And we just got to keep working.
I love it, man. And I thank you for joining us on the show today. This has been Charles Cole. Charles, tell people how they can get in touch with you, or how they can learn more about your thoughts and your ideas.
Awesome. Yes. So I do write for Huffington Post. So if you just search Charles Cole, C-O-L-E, and Huffington Post, that comes up. Or Twitter. That's the way people communicate nowadays. So I'm at C Cole the Third, and that's at C-C-O-L-E-I-I-I. And then that links to, like, my website and all that good stuff. So, and I take direct messages from parents that are fighting around advocacy and trying to get the best options for their kids. So, yeah, that's how you can get me.
Excellent. That's amazing. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today. I want to say to my listeners, thank you for joining us again for this conversation. Charles, like many people working across the nation, are really out there attempting to get the best for our kids, and it's a lot of work. It takes time and effort to really be an activist around education and to saving the children of America. I do this because one reason: our kids are worthy and they are not being served. And if we really want to be the people that we say we are, the country that we say we are, the communities that we say we are, we have to start living up to a higher level of kind of input around the love of our children. I say it all the time. Our children are precious, and they have unsurpassable worth granted to them by an amazing, amazing God. And we have to honor that every day with our actions and with our thoughts, the things that we do. The way that we vote, the way that we support schools, the way that we engage in this conversation is not an insignificant pursuit. This is critical. This is mission critical to us as parents and as communities. There is no future in neglecting and ignoring the needs, especially the intellectual needs of our children. I want to say to all my friends out there, please, please, if you like the show, go to iTunes, search for Rock the Schools with Citizen Stewart. Leave a message, comment, and like us on iTunes. You can also find me at www.citizenstewart.org, which is my website. You can find information about the podcast and contact information for me and deeper thoughts that I blog about. Thank you, friends. As always, love, peace, and soul.
This podcast has been brought to you by OMG Media Solutions on the Twin Cities News Talk Podcast Network. Go to TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com to check out all the podcasts on the Twin Cities News Talk Podcast Network. And for more information, visit OMGMediaSolutions.com.